He'd sit down at his little table and write them down, then give them to Gran to type up, then he'd draw pictures. Funny stories about animals, but real and smart. Always reminded me of that book about the spider and the pig. What's it called? Charlotte's Web? That's the one. I always thought your dad would grow up to be a writer. And in a way, I always felt like he did. The words he writes to his music, they're poetry. You ever listen carefully to the things he says? I shook my head, suddenly ashamed. I hadn't even realized that Dad wrote lyrics. He didn't sing, so I just assumed that the people in front of the microphones wrote the words. But I had seen him sit at the kitchen table with a guitar and a notepad 100 times. I just never put it together. That night, when we got home, I went up to my room with Dad's CDs and a Discman. I checked the liner notes to see which songs Dad had written, and then I painstakingly copied down all the lyrics. It was only after I saw them scrawled in my science lab book that I saw what Gramps meant. Dad's lyrics were not just rhymes. They were something else. There was one song in particular called Waiting for Vengeance that I listened to and read over and over until I had it memorized. It was on the second album, and it was the only slow song they ever did. It sounded almost country, probably from Henry's brief infatuation with hillbilly punk. I listened to it so much that I started singing it to myself without even realizing it. Well, what is this? What am I coming to? And beyond that, what am I gonna do? Now there's blankness, where once your eyes held the light. But that was so long ago. That was last night. Well, what was that? What's that sound that I hear? It's just my lifetime. It's whistling past my ear. And when I look back, everything seems smaller than life, the way it's been for so long, since last night. Now I'm leaving. Any moment I'll be gone. I think you'll notice. I think you'll wonder what went wrong. I'm not choosing, but I'm running out of fight. And this was decided so long ago. It was last night. What are you singing, Mia? Dad asked me, catching me serenading Teddy as I pushed him around the kitchen in his stroller in a vain attempt to get him to nap. Your song? I said sheepishly, suddenly feeling like I'd maybe illegally trespassed into Dad's private territory. Was it wrong to go around singing other people's music without their permission? But Dad looked delighted. My Mia's singing Waiting for Vengeance to my Teddy. What do you think about that? He leaned over to muss my hair and to tickle Teddy on his chubby cheek. Well, don't let me stop you. Keep going. I'll take over this part, he said, taking the stroller. I felt embarrassed to sing in front of him now, so I just sort of mumbled along. But then Dad joined in, and we sang softly together until Teddy fell asleep. Then he put a finger over his lips and gestured for me to follow him into the living room. "Want to play some chess?" he asked. He was always trying to teach me to play, but I thought it was too much work for a supposed game. "How about checkers?" I asked. "Sure." We played in silence. When it was Dad's move, I'd steal looks at him in his button-down shirt, trying to remember the fast-fading picture of the guy with peroxided hair and a leather jacket. Dad?
Hmm?
Can I ask you a question?
Always.
Are you sad that you aren't in a band anymore?
Nope,
he said. Not even a little bit? Dad's gray eyes met mine.
What brought all this on?
I was talking to Gramps.
Oh, I see.
You do? Dad nodded.
Gramps thinks that he somehow exerted pressure on me to change my life.
Well, did he?
I suppose in an indirect way he did. By being who he is. By showing me what a father is.
But you were a good dad when you played in a band. The best dad. I wouldn't want you to give that up for me. I said, feeling suddenly choked up. And I don't think Teddy would either.
Dad smiled and patted my hand. Mia, oh Maya, I'm not giving anything up. It's not an either-or proposition, teaching or music, genes or suits. Music will always be a part of my life.
But you quit the band, gave up dressing punk. Dad sighed. It wasn't hard to do. I'd played that part of my life out. It was time. I didn't even think twice about it, in spite of what Gramps or Henry might think. Sometimes you make choices in life, and sometimes choices make you. Does that make any sense? I thought about the cello, how sometimes I didn't understand why I'd been drawn to it, how some days it seemed as if the instrument had chosen me. I nodded, smiled, and returned my attention to the game. "King me," I said. 4:57 a.m. I can't stop thinking about Waiting for Vengeance. It's been years since I've listened to or thought of that song, but after Gramps left my bedside, I've been singing it to myself over and over. Dad wrote the song ages ago, but now it feels like he wrote it yesterday, like he wrote it from wherever he is, like there's a secret message in it for me. How else to explain those lyrics? I'm not choosing, but I'm running out of fight. What does it mean? Is it supposed to be some kind of instruction? Some clue about what my parents would choose for me if they could? I try to think about it from their perspectives. I know they'd want to be with me, for us all to be together again eventually. But I have no idea if that even happens after you die. And if it does, it'll happen whether I go this morning or in 70 years. What would they want for me now? As soon as I pose the question, I can see Mom's pissed-off expression. She'd be livid with me for even contemplating anything but staying. But Dad, he understood what it meant to run out of fight. Maybe, like Gramps, he'd understand why I don't think I can stay. I'm singing the song, as if buried within its lyrics or instructions, a musical roadmap to where I'm supposed to go and how to get there. I'm singing and concentrating and singing and thinking so hard that I barely register Willow's return to the ICU, barely notice that she's talking to the grumpy nurse, barely recognize the steely determination in her tone. Had I been paying attention, I might have realized that Willow was lobbying for Adam to be able to visit me. Had I been paying attention, I might have somehow got away before Willow was, as always, successful. I don't want to see him now. I mean, of course I do. I ache to. But I know that if I see him, I'm going to lose the last wisp of peacefulness that Gramps gave me when he told me that it was okay to go. I'm trying to summon the courage to do what I have to do, and Adam will complicate things. I try to stand up to get away, but something has happened to me since I went back into surgery. I no longer have the strength to move. It takes all my effort to sit upright in my chair. I can't run away. All I can do is hide. I curl my knees into my chest and close my eyes. I hear Nurse Ramirez talking to Willow. "I'll take him over," she says. And for once, the grumpy nurse doesn't order her back to her own patients. "That was a pretty boneheaded move you pulled earlier," I hear her tell Adam. "I know," Adam answers. His voice is a throaty whisper, the way it gets after a particularly screamy concert. "I was desperate." "No, you were romantic," she tells him. "I was idiotic. They said she was doing better before, that she'd come off the ventilator, that she was getting stronger, but after I came in here that she got worse. They said her heart stopped on the operating table." Adam trails off. "And they got it started. She had a perforated bowel that was slowly leaking bile into her abdomen, and it threw her organs out of whack. This kind of thing happens all the time, and it had nothing to do with you. We caught it and fixed it, and that's what matters." "But she was doing better," Adam whispers. He sounds so young and vulnerable, like Teddy used to sound when he got the stomach flu. "And then I came in and she almost died." His voice chokes into a sob. The sound of it wakes me up like a bucket of ice water dropped down my shirt. Adam thinks that he did this to me? No, that's beyond absurd. He's so wrong. "And I almost stayed in Puerto Rico to marry a fat SOB," the nurse snaps. "But I didn't. And I have a different life now."
Almost don't matter. You gotta deal with the situation at hand, and she's still here.
She whips the privacy curtain around my bed.
In you go, she tells Adam.
I force my head up and my eyes open.
Adam. God, even in this state, he is beautiful. His eyes are dipping with fatigue. He's sprouting stubble, enough of it that if we were to make out, it would make my chin raw.
He is wearing his typical band uniform of a t-shirt, skinny pegged pants, and Converse, with Gramps' plaid scarf draped over his shoulders. When he first sees me, he blanches, like I'm some hideous creature from the Black Lagoon. I do look pretty bad, hooked back up to the ventilator and a dozen other tubes, the dressing for my latest surgery seeping blood. But after a moment, Adam exhales loudly, and then he's just Adam again. He searches around like he's dropped something and then finds what he's looking for. My hand.
Jesus, Mia, your hands are freezing.
He squats down, takes my right hand into his, and careful not to bump into my tubes and wires, draws his mouth to them, blowing warm air into the shelter he's created.
You and your crazy hands.
Adam is always amazed at how even in the middle of summer, even after the sweatiest of encounters, my hands stay cold. I tell him it's bad circulation, but he doesn't buy it because my feet are usually warm. He says I have bionic hands, that this is why I'm such a good cello player. I watch him warm my hands as he has done 1,000 times before. I think of the first time he did it, at school, sitting on a lawn, as if it were the most natural thing in the world. I also remember the first time he did it in front of my parents. We were all sitting on the porch on Christmas Eve, drinking cider. It was freezing outside. Adam grabbed my hands and blew on them. Teddy giggled. Mom and Dad didn't say anything, just exchanged a quick look. Something private that passed between them, and then Mom smiled ruefully at us. I wonder if I tried, if I could feel him touching me. If I were to lie down on top of myself in the bed, would I become one with my body again? Would I feel him then? If I reached out my ghostly hand to his, would he feel me? Would he warm the hands he cannot see? Adam drops my hand and steps forward to look at me. He is standing so close that I can almost smell him, and I'm overpowered by the need to touch him. It's basic, primal, and all-consuming the way a baby needs its mother's breast. Even though I know if we touch, a new tug of war, one that will be even more painful than the quiet one Adam and I have been waging these past few months, will begin. Adam is mumbling something now. In a low voice, over and over, he is saying, "Please. Please. 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 Please." Finally, he stops and looks at my face. "Please, Mia," he implores. "Don't make me write a song." I'd never expected to fall in love. I was never the kind of girl who had crushes on rock stars or fantasies about marrying Brad Pitt. I sort of vaguely knew that one day I'd probably have boyfriends, in college if Kim's prediction was anything to go by, and get married. I wasn't totally immune to the charms of the opposite sex, but I wasn't one of those romantic, swoony girls who had pink, fluffy daydreams about falling in love. Even as I was falling in love, full-throttle, intense, can't-erase-that-goofy-smile love, I didn't really register what was happening. When I was with Adam, at least after those first few awkward weeks, I felt so good that I didn't bother thinking about what was going on with me. With us. It just felt normal and right, like slipping into a hot bubble bath. Which isn't to say we didn't fight. We argued over lots of stuff. Him not being nice enough to Kim, me being antisocial at shows, how fast he drove, how I stole the covers. I got upset because he never wrote any songs about me. He claimed he wasn't good with sappy love songs. "If you want a song, you'll have to cheat on me or something," he said, knowing full well that wasn't going to happen. This past fall, though, Adam and I started to have a different kind of fight. It wasn't even a fight, really. We didn't shout. We barely even argued. but a snake of tension quietly slithered into our lives. And it seemed like it all started with my Juilliard audition.
"So, did you knock them dead?" Adam asked me when I got back. "They gonna let you in with a full scholarship?"
I had a feeling that they were going to let me in, at least, even before I told Professor Christie about the one judge's "long time since we've had an Oregon country girl" comment, even before she hyperventilated because she was so convinced this was a tacit promise of admission. Something had happened to my playing in that audition. I had broken through some invisible barrier and could finally play the pieces like I heard them being played in my head, and the result had been something transcendent. The mental and physical, the technical and emotional sides of my abilities all finally blending. Then, on the drive home, as Gramps and I were approaching the California-Oregon border, I just had this sudden flash, a vision of me lugging a cello through New York City. And it was like I knew. And that certainty planted itself in my belly like a warm secret. I'm not the kind of person who's prone to premonitions or overconfidence, so I suspected that there was more to my flash than magical thinking. "I did okay," I told Adam. And as I said it, I realized that I'd just straight out lied to him for the first time, and that this was different from all the lying by omission I'd been doing before. I had neglected to tell Adam that I was applying to Juilliard in the first place, which was actually harder than it sounded. Before I sent in my application, I had to practice every spare moment with Professor Christie to fine-tune the Shostakovich Concerto and the two Bach suites. When Adam asked me why I was so busy, I gave purposely vague excuses about learning tough new pieces. I justified this to myself because it was technically true. And then Professor Christie arranged for me to have a recording session at the university so I could submit a high-quality CD to Juilliard. I had to be at the studio at 7 in the morning on a Sunday, and the night before I'd pretended to be feeling out of sorts and told Adam he probably shouldn't stay over. I'd justified that fib, too. I was feeling out of sorts because I was so nervous, so it wasn't a real lie. And besides, I thought, there was no point in making a big fuss about it. I hadn't told Kim, either, so it wasn't like Adam was getting special deception treatment. But after I told him I'd only done okay at the audition, I had the feeling that I was wading into quicksand, and that if I took one more step, there'd be no extricating myself, and I'd sink until I suffocated. So I took a deep breath and heaved myself back onto solid ground. "Actually, that's not true," I told Adam. "I did really well. I played better than I ever have in my life. It was like I was possessed." Adam's first reaction was to smile with pride. "I wish I could have seen that." But then his eyes clouded over and his lips fell into a frown. "Why'd you downplay it?" he asked. "Why didn't you call me after the audition to brag?"
"I don't know," I said.
"Well, this is great news," Adam said, trying to mask his hurt. "We should be celebrating."
"Okay, let's celebrate," I said, with a forced gaiety. "We can go to Portland Saturday, go to the Japanese gardens, and go out for dinner at Bow Tie."
Adam grimaced. "I can't. We're playing in Olympia and Seattle this weekend. Mini tour, remember? I'd love for you to come, but I don't know if that's really a celebration for you. But I'll be back Sunday late afternoon. I can meet you in Portland Sunday night if you want."
"I can't. I'm playing in a string quartet at some professor's house. What about next weekend?"
Adam looked pained. "We're in the studio the next couple weekends, but we can go out during the week somewhere, around here."
"To the Mexican place?"
"Sure. The Mexican place," I said. 2 minutes before, I hadn't even wanted to celebrate, but now I was feeling dejected and insulted at being relegated to a midweek dinner at the same place we always went to. When Adam graduated from high school last spring and moved out of his parents' place and into the House of Rock, I hadn't expected much to change. He'd still live nearby. We'd still see each other all the time. I'd miss our little powwows in the music wing, but I would also be relieved to have our relationship out from under the microscope of high school. But things had changed when Adam moved into the House of Rock and started college, though not for the reasons I'd thought they would.
At the beginning of the fall, just as Adam was getting used to college life, things suddenly started heating up with Shooting Star. The band was offered a record deal with a medium-sized label based in Seattle, and now were busy in the studio recording. They were also playing more shows, to larger and larger crowds, almost every weekend. Things were so hectic that Adam had dropped half his course load and was going to college part-time, and if things kept up at this rate, he was thinking of dropping out altogether. "There are no second chances," he told me. I was genuinely excited for him. I knew that Shooting Star was something special, more than just a college town band. I hadn't minded Adam's increasing absences, especially since he made it so clear how much he minded them. But somehow, the prospect of Juilliard made things different. Somehow, it made me mind. Which didn't make any sense at all, because if anything, it should have leveled the field. Now I had something exciting happening, too. "We can go to Portland in a few weeks," Adam promised, "when all the holiday lights are up." "Okay," I said sullenly. Adam sighed. "Things are getting complicated, aren't they?" "Yeah. Our schedules are too busy," I said. "That's not what I meant," Adam said, turning my face toward his so I was looking at him in the eye. "I know that's not what you meant," I replied. But then a lump lodged itself in my throat, and I couldn't talk anymore. We tried to diffuse the tension, to talk about it without really talking about it, to jokeify it. "You know, I read in U.S. News and World Report that Willamette University has a good music program," Adam told me. "It's in Salem, which is apparently getting hipper by the moment."
"According to who? The governor?"
I replied.
"Liz found some good stuff at a vintage clothing store there. And you know, once the vintage places come in, the hipsters aren't far behind."
"You forget, I'm not a hipster," I reminded him.
"But speaking of, maybe Shooting Star should move to New York. I mean, it's the heart of the punk scene. The Ramones, Blondie." My tone was frothy and flirtatious, an Oscar-worthy performance. "That was 30 years ago," Adam said. "And even if I wanted to move to New York, there's no way the rest of the band would." He stared mournfully at his shoes, and I recognized the joking part of the conversation had ended. My stomach lurched. An appetizer before the full portion of heartache I had a feeling was going to be served at some point soon. Adam and I had never been the kind of couple to talk about the future, about where our relationship was going, but with things suddenly so unclear, we avoided talking about anything that was happening more than a few weeks away, and this made our conversations as stilted and awkward as they'd been in those early weeks together before we'd found our groove. One afternoon in the fall, I spotted a beautiful 1930s silk gown in the vintage store where Dad bought his suits, and I almost pointed it out to Adam and asked if he thought I should wear that to the prom. But prom was in June, and maybe Adam would be on tour in June, or maybe I'd be too busy getting ready for Juilliard, so I didn't say anything. Not long after that, Adam was complaining about his decrepit guitar, saying he wanted to get a vintage Gibson SG, and I offered to get it for him for his birthday. But then he said that those guitars cost thousands of dollars, and besides, his birthday wasn't until September. And the way he said September, it was like a judge issuing a prison sentence. A few weeks ago, we went to a New Year's Eve party together. Adam got drunk, and when midnight came, he kissed me hard. "Promise me. Promise me you'll spend New Year's with me next year," he whispered into my ear. I was about to explain that even if I did go to Juilliard, I'd be home for Christmas and New Year's, but then I realized that wasn't the point. So I promised him, because I wanted it to be true as much as he did, and I kissed him back so hard, like I was trying to merge our bodies through our lips. On New Year's Day, I came home to find the rest of my family gathered in the kitchen with Henry, Willow, and the baby. Dad was making breakfast, smoked salmon hash, his specialty. Henry shook his head when he saw me. "Look at the kids today. Seems like just yesterday that stumbling home at 8 o'clock felt early. Now I'd kill just to be able to sleep until 8. "We didn't even make it till midnight," Willow admitted, bouncing the baby on her lap. "Good thing.
because this little lady decided to start her new year at 5:30.
I stayed up till midnight, Teddy yelled. I saw the ball drop on TV at 12. It's in New York, you know. If you move there, will you take me to see it drop in real life?
He asked. Sure, Teddy, I said, feigning enthusiasm. The idea of me going to New York was seeming more and more real, and though this generally filled me with a nervous, if conflicted, excitement, the image of me and Teddy hanging out together on New Year's Eve left me feeling unbearably lonely. Mom looked at me, eyebrows arched. It's New Year's Day, so I won't give you shit for coming in at this hour, but if you're hungover, you're grounded.
I'm not. I had one beer. I'm just tired.
Just tired, is it? You sure?
Mom grabbed a hold of my wrist and turned me toward her. When she saw my stricken expression, she tilted her head to the side as if to say, "You okay?" I shrugged and bit my lip to keep from losing it. Mom nodded. She handed me a cup of coffee and led me to the table. She put down a plate of hash and a thick slice of sourdough bread, and even though I couldn't imagine being hungry, my mouth watered and my stomach rumbled and I was suddenly ravenous. I ate silently, Mom watching me all the while. After everyone was done, Mom sent the rest of them into the living room to watch the Rose Parade on TV.
"Everyone out," she ordered. "Mia and I will do the washing up."
As soon as everyone was gone, Mom turned to me and I just fell against her, crying and releasing all of the tension and uncertainty of the last few weeks. She stood there silently, letting me blubber all over her sweater. When I stopped, she held out the sponge. "You wash, I'll dry. We'll talk. I always find it calming. The warm water, the soap." Mom picked up the dish towel and we went to work. And I told her about Adam and me. "It was like we had this perfect year and a half," I said. "So perfect that I never even thought about the future, about it taking us in different directions." Mom's smile was both sad and knowing. "I thought about it." I turned to her. She was staring straight out the window, watching a couple of sparrows bathe in a puddle.
"I remember last year when Adam came over for Christmas Eve. I told your father that you'd fallen in love too soon."
"I know, I know. What does a dumb kid know about love?" Mom stopped drying a skillet. "That's not what I meant. The opposite, really. You and Adam never struck me as a high school relationship," Mom said, making quote marks with her hands. "It was nothing like the drunken roll in the back of some guy's Chevy that passed for a relationship when I was in high school. You guys seemed, still seem, in love. Truly. Deeply." She sighed. "But 17 is an inconvenient time to be in love." That made me smile and made the pit in my stomach soften a little. "Tell me about it," I said. "Though if we weren't both musicians, we could go to college together and be fine." "That's a cop-out, Mia," Mom countered. "All relationships are tough. Just like with music. Sometimes you have harmony and other times you have cacophony. I don't have to tell you that."
"I guess you're right.
And come on, music brought you two together. That's what your father and I always thought. You were both in love with music, and then you fell in love with each other. It was a little like that for your dad and me. I didn't play, but I listened. Luckily, I was a little older when we met." I'd never told Mom about what Adam had said that night after the Yo-Yo Ma concert, when I'd asked him, "Why me?" How the music was totally a part of it.
"Yeah, but now I feel like it's music that's going to pull us apart."
Mom shook her head. "That's bullshit. Music can't do that. Life might take you down different roads, but each of you gets to decide which one to take." She turned to face me. "Adam's not trying to stop you going to Juilliard, is he?"
"No more than I'm trying to get him to move to New York. And it's all ridiculous anyway. I might not even go."
"No, you might not. But you're going somewhere. I think we all get that. And the same is true for Adam. At least he can go somewhere while still living here." Mom shrugged. "Maybe. For now, anyhow." I put my face in my hands and shook my head. What am I going to do? I lamented. I feel like I'm caught in a tug of war.
Mom shot me a sympathetic grimace.
I don't know. But I do know that if you want to stay and be with him, I'd support that. Though maybe I'm only saying that because I don't think you'd be able to turn down Juilliard. But I'd understand if you chose love. Adam love over music love. Either way, you win. And either way, you lose. What can I tell you? Love's a bitch.
Adam and I talked about it once more after that. We were at House of Rock, sitting on his futon. He was riffing about on his acoustic guitar. I might not get in, I told him. I might wind up at school here, with you. In a way, I hope I don't get accepted, so I don't have to choose.
If you get in, the choice is already made, isn't it? Adam asked.
It was.
I would go.
It didn't mean I'd stop loving Adam or that we'd break up, but Mom and Adam were both right. I wouldn't turn down Juilliard.
Adam was silent for a minute, plinking away at his guitar so loud that I almost missed it when he said,
I don't want to be the guy who doesn't want you to go. If the tables were turned, you'd let me go.
I kind of already have. In a way, you're already gone. To your own Juilliard, I said.
I know, Adam said quietly. But I'm still here, and I'm still crazy in love with you.
Me too, I said. And then we stopped talking for a while as Adam strummed an unfamiliar melody. I asked him what he was playing.
I'm calling it The Girlfriend's Going to Juilliard, Leaving My Punk Heart in Shreds Blues, he said, singing the title in an exaggeratedly twangy voice.
Then he smiled that goofy, shy smile that I felt like came from the truest part of him.
I'm kidding.
Good, I said.
Sort of, he added.
5:42 a.m. Adam is gone. He suddenly rushed out, calling to Nurse Ramirez that he'd forgotten something important and would be back as soon as he could. He was already out the door when she told him that she was about to get off work. In fact, she just left, but not before making sure to inform the nurse who'd relieved old Grumpy that the young man with the skinny pants and messy hair is allowed to see me when he returns. Not that it matters. Willow rules the school now. She has been marching the troops through here all morning. After Gran and Gramps and Adam, Aunt Kate stopped by. Then it was Aunt Diane and Uncle Greg. Then my cousins shuffled in. Willow's running to and fro, a gleam in her eye. She's up to something, but whether it's trotting out loved ones to lobby on behalf of my continuing my earthly existence, or whether she's simply bringing them in to say goodbye, I can't say. Now it's Kim's turn. Poor Kim. She looks like she slept in a dumpster. Her hair has staged a full-scale rebellion, and more of it has escaped her mangled braid than remains tucked inside. She's wearing one of what she calls her turd sweaters, the greenish, grayish, brownish, lumpy masses her mom is always buying her. At first, Kim squints at me, as if I'm a bright, glaring light. But then it's like she adjusts to the light and decides that even though I may look like a zombie, even though there are tubes sticking out of every which orifice, even though there's blood on my thin blanket from where it seeped through the bandages, I'm still Mia, and she's still Kim.
And what do Mia and Kim like to do more than anything?
Talk. Kim settles into the chair next to my bed.
How are you doing?
She asks. I'm not sure. I'm exhausted. But at the same time, Adam's visit has left me, I don't know what.
Agitated, anxious. Awake, definitely awake. Though I couldn't feel it when he touched me, his presence stirred me up anyhow. I was just starting to feel grateful that he was here when he booked out of here like the devil was chasing him. Adam has spent the last 10 hours trying to get in to see me, and now that he finally succeeded, he left 10 minutes after arriving. Maybe I scared him. Maybe he doesn't want to deal. Maybe I'm not the only chicken shit around here. After all, I spent the last day dreaming of him coming to me, and when he finally staggered into the ICU, if I had the strength, I would have run away.
Well, you would not believe the crazy night it's been, Kim says. Then she starts telling me about it, about her mom's hysterics, about how she lost it in front of my relatives, who were very gracious about the whole thing. The fight they had outside the Roseland Theater in front of a bunch of punks and hipsters, when Kim shouted at her crying mother to pull it together and start acting like the adult around here, and then stalked off into the club, leaving a shocked Mrs. Shine at the curb. A group of guys in spiked leather and fluorescent hair cheered and high-fived her. She tells me about Adam, his determination to get in to see me, how after he got kicked out of the ICU, he enlisted the help of his music friends, who were not at all the snobby scenesters she'd imagined them to be. Then she told me that a bona fide rock star had come to the hospital on my behalf. Of course, I know almost everything that Kim is telling me, but there is no way that she'd know that. Besides, I like having her recount the day to me. I like how Kim is just talking to me normally, like Gran did earlier, just jabbering on, spinning a good yarn as if we were together on my porch drinking coffee, or an iced caramel frappuccino in Kim's case, and catching up. I don't know if once you die, you remember things that happened to you when you were alive. It makes a certain logical sense that you wouldn't, that being dead will feel like before you were born, which is to say, a whole lot of nothingness. Except that, for me, at least, my pre-birth years aren't entirely blank. Every now and again, Mom or Dad will be telling a story about something, about Dad catching his first salmon with Gramps, or Mom remembering the amazing Dead Moon concert she saw with Dad on their first date, and I'll have an overpowering déjà vu. Not just a sense that I've heard the story before, but that I've lived it. I can picture myself sitting on the riverbank as Dad pulls a hot pink coho out of the water, even though Dad was all of 12 at the time. Or I can hear the feedback when Dead Moon played DOA at the X-Ray, even though I've never heard Dead Moon play live, even though the X-Ray Cafe shut down before I was born. But sometimes the memories feel so real, so visceral, so personal, that I confuse them with my own. I never told anyone about these memories. Mom probably would have said that I was there, as one of the eggs in her ovaries. Dad would have joked that he and Mom had tortured me with their stories one too many times and had inadvertently brainwashed me. And Gran would have told me that maybe I was there as an angel before I chose to become Mom and Dad's kid. But now I wonder. And now I hope. Because when I go, I want to remember Kim. And I want to remember her like this, telling a funny story, fighting with her crazy mom, being cheered on by punkers, rising to the occasion, finding little pockets of strength in herself that she had no idea she possessed. Adam is a different story. Remembering Adam would be like losing him all over again, and I'm not sure if I can bear that on top of everything else. Kim's up to the part of Operation Distraction when Brooke Vega and a dozen assorted punks descended upon the hospital. She tells me that before they got to the ICU, she was so scared of getting into trouble, but how when she burst inside the ward, she'd felt exhilarated. When the guard had grabbed her, she hadn't been scared at all. I kept thinking, what's the worst that could happen? I go to jail. Mom has a conniption. I get grounded for a year. She stops for a minute. But after what's happened today, that would be nothing. Even going to jail would be easy compared to losing you. I know that Kim's telling me this to try to keep me alive. She probably doesn't realize that, in a weird way, her remark frees me, just like Gramps' permission did. I know it will be awful for Kim when I die, but I also think about what she said, about not being scared, about jail being easy compared to losing me, and that's how I know that Kim will be okay. Losing me will hurt. It will be the kind of pain that won't feel real at first, and then when it does, it will take her breath away. And the rest of her senior year will probably suck, what with her getting all that cloying, your best friend's dead sympathy that will drive her so crazy. And also because, really, we are each other's only close friend at school. But she'll deal. She'll move on. She'll leave Oregon. She'll go to college. She'll make new friends.
She'll fall in love. She'll become a photographer, the kind who never has to go on a helicopter. And I bet she'll be a stronger person because of what she's lost today. I have a feeling that once you live through something like this, you become a little bit invincible. I know that makes me a bit of a hypocrite. If that's the case, shouldn't I stay? Soldier through it? Maybe if I'd had some practice. Maybe if I'd had more devastation in my life, I would be more prepared to go on. It's not that my life has been perfect. I've had disappointments, and I've been lonely and frustrated and angry and all the crappy stuff everyone feels. But in terms of heartbreak, I've been spared. I've never toughened up enough to handle what I'd have to handle if I were to stay. Kim is now telling me about being rescued from certain incarceration by Willow. As she describes how Willow took charge of the whole hospital, there is such admiration in her voice. I picture Kim and Willow becoming friends, even though there are 20 years between them. It makes me happy to imagine them drinking tea or going to the movies together, still connected to each other by the invisible chain of a family that no longer exists. Now Kim is listing all the people who are at the hospital or who have been during the course of the day, ticking them off with her fingers. Your grandparents and aunts, uncles and cousins, Adam and Brooke Vega and the various rabble-rousers who came with her, Adam's bandmates Mike and Fizzy and Liz and her girlfriend Sarah, all of whom have been downstairs in the waiting room since they got heaved out of the ICU, Professor Christie, who drove down and stayed half the night before driving back so she could sleep a few hours and shower and make some morning appointment she had, Henry and the baby, who are on their way over right now because the baby woke up at 5 a.m. and Henry called us and said that he could not stay at home any longer, and me and Mom, Kim concludes. Shoot, I lost count of how many people that was, but it was a lot, and more have called and asked to come, but your Aunt Diane told them to wait. She says that we're making enough nuisance of ourselves, and I think by us, she means me and Adam. Kim stops and smiles for a split second. Then she makes this funny noise, a cross between a cough and a throat clearing. I've heard her make this sound before. It's what she does when she's summoning her courage, getting ready to jump off the rocks and into the bracing river water. I do have a point to all this, she continues. There are like 20 people in that waiting room right now. Some of them are related to you, some of them are not. But we're all your family. She stops now, leans over me so that the wisps of her hair tickle my face. She kisses me on the forehead. You still have a family, she whispers. Last summer, we hosted an accidental Labor Day party at our house. It had been a busy season. Camp for me. Then we'd gone to Gran's family's Massachusetts retreat. I felt like I had barely seen Adam and Kim all summer. My parents were lamenting that they hadn't seen Willow and Henry and the baby in months. Henry says she's starting to walk, Dad noted that morning. We were all sitting in the living room in front of the fan, trying not to melt. Oregon was having a record heat wave. It was 10 a.m. and pushing 90 degrees. Mom looked up at the calendar. She's 10 months old already? Where has the time gone? Then she looked at Teddy and me. How is it humanly possible that I have a daughter who's starting her senior year in high school? How in the hell can my baby boy be starting second grade? I'm not a baby, Teddy shot back, clearly insulted. Sorry, kid. Unless we have another one, you'll always be my baby. Another one? Dad asked with mock alarm. Relax, I'm kidding. For the most part, Mom said. Let's see how I feel when Mia leaves for college. I'm going to be 8 in December. Then I'm a man, and you'll have to call me Ted, Teddy reported. Is that so? I laughed, spraying orange juice through my nose. That's what Casey Carson told me, Teddy said, his mouth set into a determined line. My parents and I groaned. Casey Carson was Teddy's best friend, and we all liked him a lot and thought his parents seemed like such nice people. So we didn't get how they could give their child such a ridiculous name. Well, if Casey Carson says so, I said, giggling, and soon Mom and Dad were laughing, too. What's so funny? Teddy demanded. Nothing, little man, Dad said.
It's just the heat.
Can we still do sprinklers today?
Teddy asked. Dad had promised him he could run through the sprinklers that afternoon, even though the governor had asked everyone in the state to conserve water this summer. That request had peeved Dad, who claimed that we Oregonians suffer 8 months of rain a year and should be exempt from ever worrying about water conservation.
Damn straight you can, Dad said. Flood the place if you want.
Teddy seemed placated.
If the baby can walk, then she can walk through the sprinklers. Can she come into the sprinklers with me?
Mom looked at Dad. That's not a bad idea, she said. I think Willow's off today.
We could have a barbecue, Dad said. It is Labor Day, and grilling in this heat would certainly qualify as labor.
Plus, we've got a freezer full of steaks from when your father decided to order that side of beef, Mom said.
Why not?
Can Adam come?
I asked.
Of course, Mom said. We haven't seen much of your young man lately.
I know, I said. Things are starting to happen for the band, I said.
At the time, I was excited about it, genuinely and completely. Gran had only recently planted the seed of Juilliard in my head, but it hadn't taken root. I hadn't decided to apply yet. Things with Adam had not gotten weird yet.
If the rock star can handle a humble picnic with squares like us, Dad joked.
If he can handle a square like me, he can handle squares like you, I joked back. I think I'll invite Kim, too.
The more the merrier, Mom said.
We'll make it a blowout like in the olden days.
When dinosaurs roamed the earth?
Teddy asked.
Exactly, Dad said. When dinosaurs roamed the earth, and your mom and I were young.
About 20 people showed up. Henry, Willow, the baby, Adam, who brought Fitzy, Kim, who brought a cousin visiting from New Jersey, plus a whole bunch of friends of my parents whom they had not seen in ages. Dad hauled our ancient barbecue out of the basement and spent the afternoon scrubbing it. We grilled up steaks, and, this being Oregon, tofu puffs and veggie burgers. There was watermelon, which we kept cool in a bucket of ice, and a salad made from vegetables from the organic farm that some of Mom and Dad's friends had started. Mom and I made 3 pies with wild blackberries that Teddy and I had picked. We drank Pepsi out of these old-fashioned bottles that Dad had found at some ancient country store, and I swear they tasted better than the regular kind. Maybe it was because it was so hot, or that the party was so last minute, or maybe because everything tastes better on the grill, but it was one of those meals that you know you'll remember. When Dad turned on the sprinkler for Teddy and the baby, everyone else decided to run through it. We left it on so long that the brown grass turned into a big slippery puddle, and I wondered if the governor himself might come and tell us off. Adam tackled me, and we laughed and squirmed around on the lawn. It was so hot, I didn't bother changing into dry clothes, just kept dousing myself whenever I got too sweaty. By the end of the day, my sundress was stiff. Teddy had taken his shirt off and had streaked himself with mud. Dad said he looked like one of the boys from Lord of the Flies. When it started to get dark, most people left to catch the fireworks display at the university or to see a band called Oswald 5-0 play in town. A handful of people, including Adam, Kim, Willow, and Henry, stayed. When it cooled off, Dad lit a campfire on the lawn and we roasted marshmallows. Then the musical instruments appeared. Dad's snare drum from the house, Henry's guitar from his car, Adam's spare guitar from my room. Everyone was jamming together, singing songs. Dad's songs, Adam's songs, old Clash songs, old Wipers songs. Teddy was dancing around, the blonde of his hair reflecting the golden flames. I remember watching it all and getting that tickling in my chest and thinking to myself, this is what happiness feels like. At one point, Dad and Adam stopped playing and I caught them whispering about something. Then they went inside to get more beer, they claimed, but when they returned, they were carrying my cello.
Oh, no, I'm not giving a concert, I said. We don't want you to, Dad said. We want you to play with us.
No way, I said. Adam had occasionally tried to get me to jam with him, and I always refused. Lately, he'd started joking about us playing air guitar, air cello duets, which was about as far as I was willing to go.
Why not, Mia? Kim said.
Are you such a classical music snob?
It's not that, I said, suddenly feeling panicked. It's just that the two styles don't fit together.
Says who? Mom asked, her eyebrows raised.
Yeah, who knew you were such a musical segregationist? Henry joked.
Willow rolled her eyes at Henry and turned to me. Pretty please, she said as she rocked the baby to sleep in her lap. I never get to hear you play anymore.
Come on, me, Henry said. You're among family.
Totally, Kim said. Adam took my hand and caressed the inside of my wrist with his fingers. Do it for me. I really want to play with you, just once. I was about to shake my head, to reaffirm that my cello had no place among the jamming guitars, no place in the punk rock world. But then I looked out at Mom, who was smirking at me as if issuing a challenge, and Dad, who was tapping on his pipe, pretending to be nonchalant so as not to apply any pressure, and Teddy, who was jumping up and down, though I think it was because he was hopped up on marshmallows, not because he had any desire to hear me play. And Kim and Willow and Henry all peering at me like this really mattered. And Adam, looking as awed and proud as he always did when he listened to me play. And I was a little scared of falling on my face, of not blending, of making bad music. But everyone was looking at me so intently, wanting me to join in so much, and I realized that sounding bad wasn't the worst thing in the world that could happen. So I played. And even though you wouldn't think it, the cello didn't sound half bad with all those guitars. In fact, it sounded pretty amazing.
7:16 a.m. It's morning. And inside the hospital, there's a different kind of dawn, a rustling of covers, a clearing of the eyes. In some ways, the hospital never goes to sleep. The lights stay on, and the nurses stay awake. But even though it's still dark outside, you can tell that things are waking up. The doctors are back, yanking on my eyelids, shining their lights at me, frowning as they scribble notes in my chart as though I've let them down. I don't care anymore. I'm tired of all this, and it will be over soon. The social worker is back on duty again, too. It looks like the night's sleep had little impact on her. Her eyes are still heavy, her hair a kinky mess. She reads my chart and listens to updates from the nurses on my bumpy night, which seems to make her even more tired. The nurse with the blue-black skin is also back. She greeted me by telling me how glad she was to see me this morning, how she'd been thinking about me last night, hoping I'd be here. Then she noticed the bloodstain on my blanket and tisked before hustling off to get me a new one. After Kim left, there haven't been any more visitors. I guess Willow has run out of people to lobby me with. I wonder if this deciding business is something that all the nurses are aware of. Nurse Ramirez sure knew about it. And I think the nurse with me now knows it, too, judging by how congratulatory she's acting that I made it through the night. And Willow seems like she knows it, too, with the way she's been marching everyone through here. I like these nurses so much. I hope they will not take my decision personally. I am so tired now that I can barely blink my eyes. It's all just a matter of time, and part of me wonders why I'm delaying the inevitable. But I know why. I'm waiting for Adam to come back. Though it seems like he has been gone for an eternity, it's probably only been an hour. And he asked me to wait, so I will. That's the least I can do for him. My eyes are closed, so I hear him before I see him. I hear the raspy, quick rushes of his lungs. He is panting like he just ran a marathon. Then I smell the sweat on him, a clean, musky scent that I'd bottle and wear as a perfume if I could. I open my eyes. Adam has closed his, but the lids are puffy and pink, so I know what he's been doing. Is that why he went away? To cry without my seeing? He doesn't so much sit in the chair as fall into it, like clothes heaped onto the floor at the end of a long day. He covers his face with his hands and takes deep breaths to steady himself. After a minute, he drops his hands into his lap.
Just listen,
he says, with a voice that sounds like shrapnel. I open my eyes wide now. I sit up as much as I can, and I listen. Stay. With that one word, Adam's voice catches, but he swallows the emotion and pushes forward. There's no word for what happened to you. There's no good side of it, but there is something to live for. And I'm not talking about me. It's just, I don't know. Maybe I'm talking shit. I know I'm in shock. I know I haven't digested what's happened to your parents. To Teddy. When he says Teddy, his voice cracks and an avalanche of tears tumbles down his face. And I think, I love you. I hear him take gulpfuls of air to steady himself, and then he continues. All I can think about is how fucked up it would be for your life to end here, now. I mean, I know that your life is fucked up no matter what now, forever. And I'm not dumb enough to think that I can undo that, that anyone can. But I can't wrap my mind around the notion of you not getting old. Having kids. Going to Juilliard. Getting to play that cello in front of a huge audience so that they can get the chills the way I do every time I see you pick up your bow. Every time I see you smile at me. If you stay, I'll do whatever you want. I'll quit the band, go with you to New York. But if you need me to go away, I'll do that too. I was talking to Liz, and she said maybe coming back to your old life would just be too painful, that maybe it'd be easier for you to erase us, and that would suck, but I'd do it. I can lose you like that if I don't lose you today. I'll let you go. If you stay. Then it is Adam who lets go. His sobs burst like fists pounding against tender flesh. I close my eyes. I cover my ears. I cannot watch this. I cannot hear this. But then it is no longer Adam that I hear. It's that sound. The low moan that in an instant takes flight and turns into something sweet. It's the cello. Adam has placed headphones over my lifeless ears and is laying an iPod down on my chest. He's apologizing, saying that he knows this isn't my favorite, but it was the best he could do. He turns up the volume so I can hear the music floating across the morning air. Then he takes my hand. It is Yo-Yo Ma, playing Andante con poco y molto rubato. The low piano plays almost as if in warning. In comes the cello, like a heart bleeding. And it's like something inside of me implodes. I am sitting around the breakfast table with my family, drinking hot coffee, laughing at Teddy's chocolate chip mustache. The snow is blowing outside. I'm visiting a cemetery, 3 graves under a tree on a hill overlooking the river. I am lying with Adam, my head on his chest on a sandy bank next to the river. I am hearing people say the word orphan and realize that they're talking about me. I'm walking through New York City with Kim, the skyscrapers casting shadows on our faces. I'm holding Teddy on my lap, tickling him as he giggles so hard he keels over. I'm sitting with my cello, the one Mom and Dad gave me after my first recital. My fingers caress the wood and the pegs which time and touch have worn smooth. My bow is poised over the strings now. I am looking at my hand, waiting to start playing. I am looking at my hand, being held by Adam's hand. Yo-Yo Ma continues to play, and it's like the piano and cello are being poured into my body, the same way that the IV and blood transfusions are. And the memories of my life as it was, and the flashes of it as it might be, are coming so fast and furious. I feel like I can no longer keep up with them, but they keep coming, and everything is colliding until I cannot take it anymore, until I cannot be like this 1 second longer. There is a blinding flash, a pain that rips through me for 1 searing instant, a silent scream from my broken body. For the first time, I can sense how fully agonizing staying will be. But then I feel Adam's hand. not sense it, but feel it. I'm not sitting huddled in the chair anymore. I'm lying on my back in the hospital bed, one again with my body.